Okay then, so the next speaker is Gene Warren, and again, I'm sure you would have read the bio, so I won't give that on the web, but the title of the talk is The Personal Universe, Metaphysics for the 21st Century. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm going to read it, but I will welcome questions at the end, and I think there should be some time for questions. Chris has just said what the title is, and it's also on your handout, which provides a bit of a summary. I don't think you need to follow it unless you get completely lost, but you can take it away with you. And I'm going to start with just a very brief justification for my definition of metaphysics. And the main part of the talk is intended to illustrate how thought can change if one adopts a different metaphysical starting point. At the end, I'm going to relate this to some more recent ideas about the brain. Briefly. What is metaphysics? It has been variously defined, but I like the way it is described by a late 19th century German author of A History of Philosophy, a man named Wilhelm Windelband. He wrote of the general questions which concern the actual taken as a whole, and distinguish these from those which deal with single provinces of the actual. The former, he said, formed the problem of metaphysics, called by Aristotle first science. The Oxford Companion to Philosophy says something similar. Metaphysics, it says, is the most abstract and, in some views, highfalutin part of philosophy, having to do with the features of ultimate reality, what really exists and what it is that distinguishes that and makes it possible. I like the distinction between the general questions and the single provinces, because to me, metaphysics is concerned with examining our foundational concepts, the ones which underpin our thinking and which we usually accept without question. Today, I want to examine one such concept and suggest a replacement. Our concepts do matter. They help to shape our world. If they are inadequate, they lead us astray. Human life is always problematic, but the 20th century saw an explosion of human energy, which has left us with urgent problems which need attention.
I think you could use the microphone, JP.
Okay.
There's a clip on one there.
Oh.
Rather.
Must be my accent. I don't know. I've never used one before, so apologies. No pockets, no preparation, no knowledge how it works.
You could clip it onto your.
It's working.
Yeah, but
is it working?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You can leave it on the bed.
I'll do it.
No,
because you
didn't. No, I don't. Well,
it's in. It's all right, that won't matter. Can I take what you want to say?
Modern technology.
You might have preferred clip.
Okay.
It's fine. That was fine.
Fine.
It probably was.
How's that
working? Is that working all right?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Our conception of ourselves has been faulty. Buried deep within our tradition is the assumption, a metaphysical assumption, that persons are primarily thinking individuals and are best understood when considered in that light. I want to propose instead that we conceive of persons primarily as doers. This is an approach which some existentialist thinkers adopted. But though they criticized previous philosophy, they too often rejected systematic thinking altogether. This is not a satisfactory option for those of a metaphysical bent. Why should we abandon abstract thought when considering practical human affairs? One 20th century British philosopher who refused to accept this retreat was John McMurray, He is not well known now, but he enjoyed some public recognition before the war, due partly to his lectures on philosophy for a wider audience on the BBC Third Programme. He had a distinguished academic career, which followed a fairly conventional route from tutor at Balliol College, Oxford, to professor at University College London, and finally at Edinburgh, a return to his native Scotland. McMurray was always interested in practical matters, such as politics and education, as well as in the fundamental questions of philosophy. His first published books in the early 1930s, just after he turned 40, were Freedom in the Modern World and Interpreting the Universe. In the preface to the former, he wrote, "Philosophy becomes real and therefore of interest and importance to those who are not specialists in the subject, only when its problems are forced upon it by the immediate life of its time and its environment." The problem he identified as needing attention was that of our inadequate thinking about persons. He set himself the task of seeking a solution. This he set out in his 1950s Gifford Lectures on the Form of the Personal. In talking about that solution today, I hope to illustrate metaphysics in action, so to speak. For though few have yet followed in his footsteps, I believe he's provided a useful and usable new path for philosophy to explore. McMurray was well versed in the history of philosophy. His study of the German philosophical tradition, which he could read in the original, gave him a clue to the way forward in the work of Immanuel Kant. Kant, said McMurray, had reached the conclusion that reason is primarily practical. We think according to the rules of logic and non-contradiction, but reason is broader than just giving us rules for thinking. The whole of a person's way of life is infused with reason, which is the faculty by which we manage our freedom. This freedom is primarily a freedom of action, which includes within it a freedom of thought. As McMurray puts it in describing Kant's thought, "The belief in freedom is a necessity of reason, like the belief in the law of contradiction. To reject it is to reject reason itself, not merely in the practical, but also in the theoretical field. The belief that our judgments can be true or false depends upon our belief that our actions can be right or wrong, of which indeed it is a special case." End of quote. In other words, if we were not free to accept or reject a line of thought, reason would simply not be operative, any more than it is when a river finds its way to the sea. Kant said that we cannot know that we are free. This is beyond the limits of knowledge in the realm of faith. To think otherwise is to risk falling prey to illusion, to engage in metaphysics in the bad sense of speculative reasoning. McMurray realized, however, that Kant had continued to ground his thought in the cogito, which Descartes had established as the starting point of modern philosophy. This defines a person as a thinking substance. Since Kant's objection was grounded in his acceptance of the I think as his center of reference, his objection did not necessarily have to be decisive. McMurray proposed that we try to philosophize starting from the I do, rather than the I think, from the practical rather than the theoretical. It is important to realize this does not mean that we abandon the theoretical nature of philosophy. Philosophy is necessarily theoretical, but it is possible to theorize from the standpoint of action. Similarly, Copernicus conceived the planetary system from the standpoint of the sun, but he did not have to leave the earth and travel to the sun in order to do it. What McMurray is proposing is a metaphysical shift. He is aware that, as he says, the very mention of metaphysics is apt to arouse feelings of suspicion, more or less violent and hostile, among an influential section of contemporary philosophers. He goes on, however, to say, "The doctrine that metaphysical statements are meaningless has its roots in the positivistic aspect of the critical philosophy. The ground of this judgment is that a metaphysical assertion cannot be verified because it purports to refer beyond the limits of possible experience. Unquote. He says that the objection is justified from the standpoint of the primacy of the theoretical, of the I think. But, he goes on, this conclusion is valid only on the assumption that the theoretical standpoint is the only possible standpoint. If this is not so, then the conclusion may be taken as a reductio ad absurdum of that standpoint. Unquote. The weakness of the positivist case, he says, is in its understanding of verification, which must be taken to have a wider meaning if one philosophizes from the I do rather than the I think. It must include the effects of actions in the world. History can falsify metaphysical assumptions about persons. We should notice that we cannot ask in advance if an attempt to replace the I think with the I do is possible. To do so is to presuppose the primacy of the theoretical, the very thing which the proposed new approach is rejecting. We can only simply try to do it. It is immensely difficult because it involves transforming our habits of thought. Even a failure is worthwhile, however, because it may provide a stepping stone to future success. So what would philosophy from the standpoint of action look like? To start with, we realize that action includes thought. Our Cartesian heritage posits a dualism between theory and practice, an unbridgeable gulf between the two. If we substitute the practical standpoint, the dualism between theory and practice disappears. In thinking, the mind alone is active. In acting, both the body and mind are active. Action is not an alternative to thought, it is a more complete concept, including the thinking self within the acting self. Action and thought are the two poles of our personal experience. Theoretically conceived, they are two opposed concepts, but in actuality, one includes the other. Action includes thought, but thought does not include action. Thus, action is primary in a way that thought is not. By reflecting from the standpoint of action, we do not exclude thought, we include it as a necessary, though subordinate, component. To be clear about terms, the term action is being used to mean activity which is intended. Thus, action without thought is a self-contradictory concept. We can act without thinking, but by this we mean that we acted without sufficient thinking. If while preoccupied, we answer a question put to us in a way we later regret, we do not consider that our answer involved no thinking at all, for without thinking we cannot speak. The subject of talking in our sleep raises interesting questions about unconscious thinking, which I will not go into here, except to say that an infant who has not yet learned to talk does not talk in its sleep. The self in its completeness, McMurray calls the self as agent, which is also the title of the first volume of his Giger lectures. The thinking self is a restricted mode of operation of this self. McMurray calls it the self as subject. The self as subject is separated from the world it thinks about, and it is confronted with problems such as, how do I know that the world exists? The self as agent knows the world as that which both supports and resists its action. It is the self as subject which asks the question, how do we know that the self is agent? From the point of view of the self as agent, this question has no force. It arises from the theoretical standpoint, the one we are rejecting. We might as well go back and ask Descartes, how do we know that the self is thinker? He would have replied that the very question indicates that the self who asks it is a thinker. To doubt is to think. For the self as agent, knowledge that he or she is an agent follows from being one. The practical is philosophically primary. Because the self as agent includes the self as subject, McMurray proposes a philosophical form of the personal, which sees the person not as a synthesis of a dialectic, this McMurray calls the form of the organic, but as a positive which necessarily contains its own negative. The negative is not something bad, but rather something less complete or something at the opposite pole. Thus above, I described action and thought as being opposite poles of our experience. They are not two sides of a dialectic. They are dimensions or poles of the complete experience of each of us. Both are necessary, but the positive action is more complete than the negative thought. Another example. A complete person includes an organic body. The personal includes the organic as its necessary negative. Or we could say more generally that the personal includes the impersonal as its negative. This pattern recurs throughout McMurray's analysis. The implications of the new metaphysical presupposition, which sees individuals primarily as doers rather than primarily as thinkers, are worked out in the first volume of the Gifford Lectures, with chapters on such things as perception, causality, and modes of reflection. But in this volume is also an acknowledgement that the individual in isolation cannot represent the complete actuality of the personal, which demands the interpersonal for its completeness. An organism becomes a person only in relation with other persons. For the sake of simplicity of analysis, this aspect of the personal is ignored in the first volume, but that does not make it any less important. Our culture tends to be individualistic, seeing personal relations as an add-on. The habit of starting from I think makes this almost inevitable, as thinking is something that we do individually. On the other hand, the self who acts is inherently a self in relation with other selves and the world. Thinking isolates us. Thought does not change the thing thought about. Action, on the other hand, affects the world. My action encounters the world as both support and resistance. It is these encounters which give me my initial knowledge of the world, without which I would have little to think about. A special subset of the world is other persons. How do I know another person? This cannot be achieved without meeting and interacting with them. Sometimes we may say when we meet someone we've heard about, I feel as if I know you already. The as if shows that we don't yet feel we quite know them, even though we may know a lot about them. If we base our philosophy on the I think, we can only think of another person as another I. As McMurray puts it, any philosophy which takes the I think as its first principle must remain formally a philosophy without a second person, a philosophy which is debarred from thinking of the you and I, end quote. Our thinking about the interpersonal in these circumstances is likely to be of an impersonal kind, concentrating on aggregates and systems rather than on relations, of which friendship would be the paradigm. Do you not think, looking around the contemporary world, that this has indeed happened? Recently, my attention was drawn to a striking example of a failure to realize the importance of personal relationship. In 1995 in Massachusetts, a pair of twins were born premature and very small. The latest technology was used in the intensive care unit, and one of the girls was doing well, but the smaller, weaker one seemed to be losing her fight for life. As a last resort, a nurse decided to put them together in the same cot, a technique she remembered hearing about somewhere. The effect was immediate. From that day, both twins thrived, and at 2 months old, they were allowed to go home. Doctors had been worried about the risk of infection, but they had been oblivious to the risk of isolation. Once the tiny baby had refound her twin, life began to seem worth living. This practice gradually spread to other hospitals, not, it seems, because of a light bulb moment of insight on the part of clinicians trained in conventional medicine, but because the practice could now be supported by research. All of McMurray's work emphasized the importance of the interpersonal, but in the second volume of his Gifford Lectures, given the title Persons in Relation, he considers the topic as part of his rigorous analysis of the philosophical form of the personal. The tradition of Plato and Aristotle, which rested on their conviction that the theoretical life was the good life, led directly to the I think. It had the effect of making other selves, or we could say other minds, problematic. One assumes that Aristotle knew that his students existed and had minds. It would be sensible to have a way of thinking about the world which makes this assumption primary, something to be presupposed, rather than something needing to be proved. This, McMurray suggests, is what can be achieved by thinking from the standpoint of the practical, of the I do. Action means interaction with the world, which includes other people. This is a primary reality constitutive of personal being. McMurray points out that personal knowledge of another person includes an impersonal element, an element which includes what science tells us about people in general, or what can be known about a particular individual without being acquainted with them. The personal contains the impersonal as its necessary negative. He also points out that the theory of the person, of the personal, which he is proposing, is philosophical and not scientific. Science examines persons impersonally. The difference has to do with intention. Persons are agents, and action is intentional. Intention is what distinguishes action from behavior, that is, from activity which happens rather than being done. As McMurray explains, action cannot be object for a subject. For a purely objective attitude reduces action to behavior and represents it as matter of fact, not as matter of intention. End quote. Science, in other words, does not do personal action. It must deal in facts. And to quote McMurray again, what is intended is never matter of fact, though it may be a fact that I intended. In Persons in Relation, McMurray begins with the infant and its primary carer, on whom its very survival depends. Almost its only instinctive behavior is to cry when distressed. Its personhood develops from the beginning in relationship, long before it learns to talk. The relationship is its primary reality. Only later does it separate itself out and think of itself as a separate individual. It goes from dependence to independence, but then progresses to interdependence, to functioning as a member of a personal community. This is the fullest expression of personhood. McMurray examines the problematic nature of personal relations in the areas of ethics, politics, and religion. Our responses to each other range from those based on fear to those based on love. The fearful responses can be either defensive or aggressive. We need systems of justice to manage the inevitable problems which arise from relations based on fear. Our political and economic systems are the functional underpinnings which enable a community of friendship to flourish. Friendship is for its own sake, not for the sake of something else. By friendship, McMurray means an open, positive attitude to one another in which we feel we can be ourselves. Perhaps there's no good word for this, but I heard descriptions of some such atmosphere from people who went to London during the Olympic Games. Religion, says McMurray, is about just this, the loving community. It cannot be understood by a philosophy without a you, because it is about the you and I. Quote, religion, we may say, is the knowledge of the other as community. The classical way of thinking about ourselves as a combination of material body and immaterial mind or spirit does not work. it leaves us with such conundrums as the mind-body problem. In McMurray's words, it denies the I do and substitutes on the one hand an I think, and on the other, an it happens. It must either assert that the relation of mind and matter is an insoluble mystery, which, if it is accepted, must rest upon a dogmatic credo quia impossibile, or it must deny either the reality of matter or the reality of mind, and have resort either to a pure materialism or a pure spiritualism. In either case, what is denied is action. End quote. McMurray ends by asking the question, is what exists personal? He seeks to show that any impersonal conception of the world is inadequate. When Wittgenstein says the world is everything that is the case, he is, says McMurray, asserting that the world is mere matter of fact, whereas the world also contains, quote, everything that appears to be the case but is not, error, stupidity, and evil, the illusions of the wishful thinker and the nonsense of the metaphysician are in the world. And any conception of the world which excludes them is an inadequate conception. The world must be such that it can produce such creatures as we are, and must contain in itself the possibility of a problematical activity like our own. End quote. Last year, I read a recent book relating brain structure to Western culture called The Master and His Emissary by Ian McGilchrist. It puts forward the thesis that each hemisphere of the brain presents us with a different world. The right hemisphere keeps us in touch with the outside world, with its varied and sometimes confusing or conflicting messages to us. It provides us with a broad, flexible attention. The left hemisphere produces for us a coherent world, one where the contradictions are resolved. It provides us with local, narrowly focused attention. It struck me that McMurray's thought could be seen as a striving for a right hemisphere concept of the world from the left hemisphere discipline of philosophy. McMurray even says at one point, a philosophy which starts from the I think is committed by its starting point to an ineradicable dualism. The knower is then a pure subject, a mere observer, an isolated self, imprisoned in the fortress of his own ideas and incapable of breaking out. Starting from the ideas he finds in himself, he can reach out to other ideas, but he can never reach anything that exists. Unquote. But Murray's whole philosophical project can be seen as an attempt to forge a more adequate metaphysics. McGilchrist, a former consultant psychiatrist and also a researcher in neuroimaging, makes use of the sort of brain research which wasn't around in Murray's day. Research with brain damage patients, or more recently with experimental temporary inhibition of one hemisphere, shows many examples of the differences between the two hemispheres. Both hemispheres contribute to almost everything that we do, but in different ways. The best working relationship, he says, is for the right hemisphere, the one with the wider and more outward focus of attention, to pass things to the left hemisphere for processing, and then to receive back the results. This means that the left hemisphere has a somewhat subordinate position. However, each hemisphere has a capacity to inhibit the other to some degree. McGilchrist thinks that the left hemisphere may have become too dominant in modern Western people, leading to a culture with a worldview increasingly out of touch with reality. Heidegger, McGilchrist thinks, was very important in the history of modern philosophy because he was able to go beyond the tradition he inherited and reconnect philosophy with the parts of reality which it had lost sight of. The fact that he valued poetic language helped. In an interesting paragraph, McGilchrist says, philosophy and philosophical discourse is only one way of understanding the world. Most people who instinctively see the world in Heideggerian terms don't become philosophers. Philosophers are self-selected as those who feel they can account for or at any rate sensibly question reality in the very terms that would need to be transcended if we are to do justice to the right hemisphere's reality. There are notable exceptions, however, end of quote. As well as Heidegger, McGilchrist cites Schopenhauer and Wittgenstein. I have ascertained that he has not read McMurray. One of McMurray's early books is called Reason and Motion. Throughout his career, he continued to champion, from the point of view of the philosopher, the importance of feeling as well as intellect. Only by using both faculties, he thought, could an adequate concept of the world be formed in the mind. McGilchrist says, in the same paragraph just quoted, I believe that, despite appearances, philosophy begins and ends in the right hemisphere, though it has to journey through the left hemisphere on its way. Unquote. In a philosophical tradition often stuck in the left hemisphere, so to speak, concerned with logic and analysis to the exclusion of inconvenient experience, McMurray's concern for the person as a living reality rather than an abstract or generalized body or mind places him firmly in the actual world. His determination to formulate a philosophically adequate form of the personal is his way of reconnecting philosophy with that world. It is the sort of reality check from which philosophy can only benefit.
Right, thank you very much, and we've got quite a good bit of time. We're going to run a little bit later, so we've still got 15 minutes to talk the questions, so please.
Isn't it a difficulty for Murray's position that it is precisely thinking, thought, that distinguishes us from other animals? All animals are pretty good agents, but only the higher apes have what looks like the beginnings of thought. But surely it's thought that makes us different from and often would say superior to other animals. It's Homo sapiens who started thinking.
It's not a difficulty in his terms, because for two reasons. One is action includes thinking. He says without thought you don't have action, and he believed that we were the only animals that act. He believed that other animals behave. Now, I think, partly just because I've thought about it and times have moved on, I think certainly the higher apes do intend. They act with intention. I think we see that. And I don't know how far, I don't think it goes down to earthworms or lilies, you know, somewhere it kind of peters out. He was interested in us, and he wasn't interested in how far down it went, so he didn't devote a lot of writing to that issue. But very, very definitely, we could not act without our capacity to think.
Thank you.
Bob?
Yeah, it seemed to me that no matter what McMurray says, and I think I've never written that, but going from what you're saying, is common sense.
Yes.
That no one's ever really disagreed with the importance of personal relations, the importance of action and so on. And McMurray himself, in talking about this, is just taking the role of a thinker standing outside the system and talking about it, including talking about emotions and relationships and actions and so on, just like any other philosopher. And I'm not quite sure how what he says, the common sense aspect, leads to any great disturbance of the philosophical tradition.
Well, I tried to give with an illustration of the two baby twins.
But isn't that just common sense?
Well, why don't hospitals already do it then?
Well, they wouldn't. Presumably they'd only do it if they had some reason to suppose it worked, which they now do.
Well, no. If you believe that the interpersonal was primary, then you get two baby. It happens that my daughter is a twin, so this particularly spoke to me. And she lost her twin at birth. Her twin was stillborn. But she has very definite. She knows that she knew that twin in the womb in some sense. Now, if we really believed in the value of personal relationship, as they're now doing with this little four-year-old girl, you know, the most important thing is relationship. And cross-infection comes a poor second. And they don't know that. Medical schools do not know that.
But they should, because it's a fact.
But they don't. They do not act on it. They do not know it in a way that informs their action. For some reason. You and I might know it, but they, whole systems of medicine, do not.
A gentleman in the purple tie.
There's a neurophysiological observation that follows McMurray, and that is that when a movement is anticipated at the lowest level of thought and movement, there is a potential that can be measured in the brain, in the area concerned with the limb involved, which is called the preparedness potential.
Yes.
And it hadn't hitherto been thought that there was anything which anticipated the movement itself.
Yes.
So this is something which does blur the distinction between thought and action.
Well, I don't think it does. Partly, I'm just convinced that it doesn't. But partly, this is the Libet experiments you're talking about. I thought about this a lot, because I went to a conference this summer at St. Anne's on persons and their brains, and Rita Carter gave a very, very clear exposition of the Libet experiments, as one talk. And several things occurred to me at the time. One was, what causes that readiness potential? And she looked a bit nonplussed and said, the situation, or the conditions. Which isn't really sense. You know, what isn't caused by, you know. So I thought, you know, why just then did this readiness potential kick in? Secondly, I thought this really highlights the unconscious and how so much of our thinking or something that goes on in us at an unconscious level. And here's why I think McMurray doesn't, for many reasons, historical reasons, but I mean, he appreciated Freud very much and said, we've got to look at this. And all his colleagues poo-pooed him for even saying that. But I think there's a lot about the unconscious that we will discover. But to say, you know, unless you can explain what caused that readiness potential.
Think about a tennis player who has to hit a ball going too fast.
Yes.
He has practiced it many times, so it does come back to the conditions. He recognizes the conditions and puts himself in a preparedness state, and he acts in words that you can see.
And I think that, you see, I think that's a different case. I mean, that really happens, you know. He's not thought about it, he just does it. But with this Libet experiment, you were actually asked to sit there, and then at some point you had a clock going around, and you were to look at this clock, and you're going to say, right, I'm going to lower my finger now and look at the clock and write down the time. So that's very different from the tennis player.
Right. Thank you, Roger. Thank you, Ivor. Need to give everybody a chance. So, Alan, you're the next one.
Thank you. I thought there was a lot of that which does seem to be interesting and useful. That science examines persons impersonally, persons are agents and action is intentional, and the emphasis on intentionality is not a problem. Quaidian was saying at one point philosophy is necessarily theoretical, and it does seem to me that by boosting the action beyond what Hume would say, which is reason is the slave of the emotions, I mean, there's a lot in philosophy which does boost action over reason, but that he is in danger of chucking out the self as subject. You say that's the negative which is contained by the positive, which is self as agent. And that kind of rhetoric seems to me to leave out the fact, the inescapable, awkward mind-body fact, that we do know what's going on in each of us separately in a way we don't know what's going on in anyone else. And so saying self as subject is to be ignored in favour of self as agent is it seems to me going precisely down the impersonal track, which he actually wants to avoid, and appreciating other people as subjects who think and feel and decide and intend like we do, is part of what any philosophical account has to include. And so it's a sort of synthesis which I think he's got at least half of, but I think maybe it sounds to be some other extreme.
If I said what you said, I said, but I didn't. He never, ever, I mean, he's a philosopher, he never says to ignore the self as subject. And he says it is the negative which is essential. I can't remember the actual quote. It is an essential constituent. It is the necessary, the negative is necessary. I mean, my one little feeble example is you have an American style donut that's always round with a hole. It wouldn't be a donut without the hole. You could not have, you know, the hole is essential. But, I mean, that's a poor analogy because thinking is far more to him. And he is a thinker. He is saying that you think from the, I've lost track of part of what you asked, but thinking is an essential constituent of action.
Mm.
Without it, you don't act.
Yeah, but thinking introspectively and experiencing one's own subjective experience is just as important as
it's essential. Absolutely. Without it, you know.
Well, okay. Common sense summary, certainly.
He couldn't have written that book. And he says, thinking is a form of action. That's in another essay that I read after this. But thinking is hard work, and it's a form of action, but a form of action that does not involve movement.
Can you say a bit about what Murray thinks about emotions? Because I'm sort of thinking that there's more coming out now saying that actions sort of precede emotions. If you act in a certain way, then you'll feel that emotionally. And currently, the media very much focus on the emotion as opposed to the action. So if we watch the sports, it's only a close-up of the tennis player's emotion rather than hitting the ball. But I just wonder if you could expand a bit on what McMurray sees emotion.
Well, just very briefly, in the book Reason and Emotion, he goes into it. He thinks that we have a feeling thing and a thinking. And we have the intellect and the emotions, so we have feeling and thinking. And he thinks they're both rational faculties. And I believe this accords with what Jung would say as well. And so he says we have neglected our feeling. We have failed to educate it, and it is fairly barbaric. And probably even more so in his day. If you're watching Parade's End on the telly, I mean, that's back at the time that he was a young man. And you just see the total horrible messes they get into because they have no idea what their feelings are doing to them. He said education ought to develop the whole person, and you would develop feeling through artistic work, through having a school community where everybody's a valued member, all that kind of thing, as well as educating the intellect. Now, if you have an educated feeling, you are able to make judgments and values. You're able to distinguish the sentimental from the genuine. You're able to distinguish hype from the genuine. I mean, he really has a go at that bad counterfeit emotion in his other book. I think it's about it.
That's right.
I just wanted to clarify Roger's point of the action potential. I thought that the issue was that it doesn't matter where it came from, it only mattered that it was not, didn't enter the consciousness at the time when it arrived.
Well, that's their take on it. But my take on it is it does matter. It matters that it happened when it happened, because why didn't it happen 5 minutes later? You know?
Well, if you want me to comment, I would assume that they suggest the primacy of the brain over the consciousness.
But why did the brain do it just then?
Well, from my point of view, it doesn't matter. It's okay. All that matters is the brain is primary.
Well, I think we'd better not go further
down
that route.
Charles.
You said there's no, I think it was, there's no action without thinking, is that right?
Yeah.
That seemed to imply, though you didn't say it explicitly, that both are only conscious. In other words, there can be no action
In other words, that thinking is essentially conscious and that action is essentially conscious. There can be no action produced by the unconscious.
Yeah, he said that. Now, that's why I brought in about sleepwalking or talking in your sleep. I think the unconscious, I think we need to think about how the unconscious and the conscious interact.
Well, if you take dreaming to be unconscious, and for that dreaming to produce action, for example, I might sleepwalk.
Exactly.
I have no problem there.
I think he would call that behavior.
Action can be unconsciously triggered.
I think he might call that behavior. Mm.
Ah, yes. The other problem there is, of course, that comes in there, the reason you want action and consciousness is to act as a vehicle for responsibility. Mm. If you throw responsibility into this sleeping, dreaming one, it's a slightly different cocktail.
That's why I would say it was behavior.
Let's thank Jean once again.